Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Welcome to the Behind the Racket Pod, the podcast taking you behind the racket with today's top tennis players and biggest issues facing the sport.
Behind the Racket is a community to give fans and players in the world of tennis the opportunity to open up like they have never done before.
Visit BehindTheRacket.com for the latest stories, merch, as well as direct links to all of the latest podcasts. It can also be found on iTunes, Google Play, Pandora, Stitcher, and wherever you find your podcasts. Download the episodes and make sure to leave a review.
And we want you to be a part of the conversation. Find me at NoahRubin33 or Mike at MikeCTennis on all forms of social media. You can also learn more at BehindTheRacket.com or MikeCTennis.com.
Special thanks to my sponsor, New Balance. Visit their latest shoes and styles at NewBalance.com and learn more about their program of giving back at #NBGivesBack.
You can also help support the podcast by visiting patreon.com/behindtheracketpod and receive rewards from our travels around the world. And now.
You know, we have a guy here on the podcast in Noah Rubin who, technically, back in his heyday, when he was 17 years of age, won a junior Grand Slam. Big moment in his life, you know, when you get the little trophy. But we're really excited this week to be joined by somebody who's won a real Grand Slam, Rajiv Ram, who I've known actually since he was 17 as well. And Rajiv, thank you for joining us this week. We really do appreciate it.
Yeah, very happy to be here.
Not only did you throw out a compliment to a friend,
yeah,
you also got to shit on me at the same time, which right. is honestly, you are a wizard.
Like a double win, huh? It's a yeah. good start.
Rajiv and I have known each other, like I said, since he was 17 when he was recruited to play at the University of Illinois for Craig Tiley when I was just starting to get involved with the program as well. Let's see, since then I've gained a lot of weight. You've lost a lot of hair.
But you know, saw from those pictures.
Yeah, I have some pictures of my brothers who were, I think, 13 years of age with Rajiv while he was a freshman at the University of Illinois. It's crazy because I've obviously seen you grow into the man you've become, a Grand Slam champion. Now it's a really unique perspective, and it's been a lot of fun. And I guess how have when you were 17, when you were going to college for the first time, was this anything like what you expected?
Well, it's a good question. I think it's always something that, you know, you want as a player. Like by the time I was to the point of going to school, I'd already felt like I wanted to give professional tennis a shot. So in knowing that, I mean, yeah, you want to shoot for, you know, reaching the higher levels of the game and, you know, and playing there for a while, obviously, but I feel like that being said, I can't say that I ever expected to be in the position. I think you just sort of try and work each day and, you know, do the little things that you can to get to where you can be as good of a player as you can be. And hopefully that turns out to, you know, achieve certain goals and whatnot. But then it is always, for me, it's still a bit of a shock that, you know, like some of these things have happened and I've been lucky enough to experience them, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of started out with the college career, and I think a lot of people asked me, they're like, did you go into college thinking it was going to be a 1 year done, complete? Did you know you were going to leave after a year? And I'm just curious to hear from you, what was kind of your plan going in?
Yeah, I probably thought more along the lines of it would be definitely not 4 years. You know, I don't know that I thought it would be so short, but, you know, college was going to always be a stepping stone. I saw college going to Illinois, especially as a way to improve my tennis and as a way to basically, you know, take the next step to becoming a professional. But if I could do it again, I will say if I could do my college career over again, I would have stayed one more year. Mm-hmm. I think I would have been well served to stay a bit longer because I just wasn't ready for the rigors of the tour. My game wasn't ready. I wasn't ready, but at the time in 2003 or four around that time, it was like people's careers ended at 30. So I felt like, man, if I start at 20, I may have 10 years to go and that's it. So I better get started. And now it's like, I'm 36. I turned 36 earlier in March and it's like, yeah, I probably could play another few more years, I think. So it's like, if I had sort of had that hindsight, if you will, I would have for sure stayed another year, maybe even longer.
Yeah, I mean, that actually kind of answers my second question. But, you know, to follow up with that, you know, I'm looking back and sorry, I am a little younger than you, but
you're younger than both of us.
I am looking back and not looking if I was ready or not, but more looking on this, you know, on the lens of what I enjoyed another year or two, you know, going along the same lines of longevity in tennis and professional tennis, but would I have enjoyed more of that team atmosphere for another year? But you would have said that you would have enjoyed another year, but is that for becoming more professional or is that for enjoyment as well?
I think it's for both. I think, but I was in a really unique situation. I'm not saying you weren't. I just know that my situation was, we had a fantastic coach and a great team and we had a real good situation to improve, you know, and to work on my tennis and to just become a better player, become a better athlete, do all the things that were required to be, you know, a bit better prepared for professional tennis. And I think I had all that and I decided to leave it in thinking that I was sort of maybe, I'm not gonna say running out of time, but I certainly felt like I maybe had a limit that, you know, I had on the end of my career. And so that weighed in huge to my decision of not going back. And now looking back on it, you know, where I am today, I've well exceeded the limit that I thought I would be playing until. So I think, you know, I think that was sort of the reasoning at the time. And I just know I had a great situation. I knew I had one even in the beginning. It's not like I didn't know it then. I knew it then that I had a great situation. I just felt like, you know, I wanted to, you know, take the next step at that point.
And that college coach, of course, Craig Tiley, tournament director, CEO of Tennis Australia and tournament director of the Australian Open, where you did win your slam. I, having been around the program myself, Raj, I know how important it was for him to structure what he did with you guys towards building you to be the best version of yourself as a professional. I'm wondering what you still take from those days and working with him, even in the first couple of years out of college, what lessons you learned that you still implement within how you develop yourself today?
Yeah, it was, funnily enough, I spent such a short time there, but I took quite a few lessons, and I think I would be, you know, pretty fortunate to have been around, you know, that group in that sort of situation. I think one of the things I'll say that I always say to everyone is, Craig was one of the best, if not the best leader of like a team that I'd ever seen. You know, he put together a situation where everybody felt like they were the most important person there, which is really difficult to do, you know, and he did that sort of by tapping in to the different personalities that we had. We had egos on the team. We had all kinds of different things, but he made it so where everybody felt like they got their little piece, you know? And for me, it was a lot of the structure, a lot of the looking at the future goals and looking at, you know, me wanting to be a professional and all this and that. And he really kind of fed that to me. And I still think, you know, I think about that stuff going even now at this point. It's like, it's not necessarily about winning. It's not necessarily about, you know, the result, but being a bit more process oriented. How can you develop your game? How can you do it? Even today, I mean, it's a lot different than when I was 20 years old, but there's still things I can get better at. There's still things I can do. So just sort of that thought process. And then, you know, he helped me with certain specific technical things I still think back at, you know, even today, but it was more of just a mindset thing I think he was really good at. And, you know, having that sort of futuristic sort of like, what do you call it? Sort of not outcome-based, but performance-based, you know, process that he put in, I think is still a big deal for me.
You know, we've been very fortunate. You've given us a lot of time. You will be featured on Behind the Racket blog very soon. And we spoke a lot about a few different things. But the one that I want to talk to, because, again, I use your name a lot for this, is obviously you've had a very successful singles and doubles career. But you're somebody that has looked in the mirror one day and you're like, this is how I'm going to play my singles. I am going to do this and I'm going to do it very well. Mm-hmm. How long did it take to get to that process? What did it take? What realizations did it take to get there for you to say, this is what I'm going to do? And then you quartered, you know, 6 ATPs in a row and we were playing really well.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of it was realizing what I couldn't do. I mean, that's the first thing. Like, I mean, I went through a stage when I first started playing when, you know, tennis began to change right about then. I mean, like, the first time I ever saw polyester strings, Luxlon, for example, was when we played Vanderbilt in the finals of the NCAAs. I was like, you got six guys who are out there who, you know, a few of them are pretty good. A few of them I didn't think were that good. And they're all playing unbelievable tennis. The ball doesn't ever go out. You know, how does this work? And then you come to the tour and you have all these European guys and everyone, you know, and tennis was just, the whole makeup was changing. So like, then I figured, well, I better change with the times. And then 3 or 4 years go by and it's just not happening for me. Like, I can't hit the ball like that. I can't run like these guys can. I can't do a lot of the things that they do. So figured if I had to sort of make my way, I sort of had to bring in elements of what I knew I could do well and try to fit them into the current situation that we had, you know? So it took a while, man. Like, it wasn't an easy thing for me at all to try and figure that out. And then, you know, changing equipment, doing a lot of different things to try and, it was like trying to fit pieces together that maybe didn't necessarily fit all that well, you know? So you had to chip away at some different things. But, you know, in the end, I felt like I found a pretty good balance. It was a little later than I'd hoped, but I found a pretty good balance of how I could make it work to a certain extent. And yeah, I played some pretty good tennis for sure towards the end of my career. More than good, I felt like I played consistent tennis towards the end of my career, more so. Because I always felt like, even at the beginning, if I played well, I was pretty tough to beat. But then I had so many days where I just didn't play that well. And then the consistency was an issue that I felt like I did better with later on.
You know, to be honest, I really wish you found it a little bit later. Here's a little Jewish New Yorker trying to make his way, qualified for Indian Wells. I believe possibly had a set point somewhere along the way.
I remember you served for the second set. I don't know that it was a set point, but I remember you served for the second set.
And here's this forehand. He's just lumbering with that forehand line. And I'm like, you got to be fucking kidding me. So he's like taking one step, covers the court. I'm Roadrunner in circles, like it's like a cartoon. I'm like, gotta be kidding me. His wife is clapping. I'm like, get me the fuck out of here.
To be fair, that was once I reached that high, I knew it wasn't going to get any higher than that. So I knew it was going to be all downhill from there.
Great match. It was a lot of fun, actually.
It was a lot of fun. I played a really good match against you there. I do remember that.
Yeah, thanks.
I don't know that I've ever actually asked you this. The nickname of Rampress. I mean, are you cognizant of it on tennis Twitter? I mean, are you cognizant of the
fact? It's hard not to be at this point. Yeah.
I mean, your thoughts on that? Because that's obviously a lofty comparison.
Yeah. I mean, I wish I was a bit closer in career statistics to the person I get compared to. But no, I mean, I obviously have a lot of similarities in terms of style, if you will, not necessarily ability, but style. And I think that's just sort of how I groomed my own game. I mean, I didn't really have a coach until I was quite late in my development, maybe about 13 years old. So I mean, my tennis started by, you know, watching players that I felt like I, you know, could look at and do what they do, or at least try to do what they do. Players who came forward, players who, you know, played an aggressive style. And you know, I grew up in that era, right, when we had a bunch of really good Americans. You know, another one that I looked at quite a lot was Todd Martin. He's not, you know, not nearly as maybe, you know, touted as Sampras was. But, I mean, Todd was another guy who I related a lot to. He wasn't the quickest guy around the court, but he could hit the ball awfully well, a bit taller, you know, served well, came in quite a lot when he played. So, like, those two guys, I'd say, out of the group of Americans that I grew up watching were the two that I related to the most. And I just, you know, my tennis kind of started by trying to copy what they did. And I guess I was okay at it because everyone thinks that I look like Pete when I play, so to a certain extent, at least.
So let's hypothetical here. Say the technical changes in terms of just the strings, the rackets. You take those out. What do you think your career would have looked like if you played in the mid 90s?
I mean, that's a really tough question. I guess I don't know. I think I would have been a bit more consistent. I'm not sure I would have been better, worse. I don't really know, but I just think that my natural style would have fit into a few more consistent results. You know, I think the court surfaces, I think certain situations would have been a bit more in my favor. So I wouldn't have felt like I would have had to have played as well as I needed to sometimes to get results. I think I would have been able to win matches without always playing, you know, at a really high level because the conditions and the sort of makeup of the game would have lended itself to more to what I just did well naturally, you know.
I mean, you keep you keep talking about consistency. I would like to think you had a pretty good career overall. And
yeah, no, I did. I'm not saying that, but I did have a lot of, you know, like I got to 60 and then I got to, you know, then I went back down to 150 and then I went to, you know, 70. There's a lot of that. Whereas I think if it was
75
more,
range throughout.
Yeah, it would have been a bit more, you know, in that range of, you know, whatever it was, whatever the bottom might be, whether it was 70 or 50 or 40, I don't know, I would have been able to stay there a bit more consistently. That's what I'm trying to say, I guess.
Wouldn't you miss the challenges, though? They're so much fun.
They are so much fun. They are so much fun. Oh, man.
But yeah, no, let's kind of transition to, I guess, what you're known for now is having a second guy on the court with you. And
yes,
you know, what some people are going to find out through the Behind the Racket blog and other people know is, you don't consider 58 tries. And that's what we kind of harped on during the conversation we had. And, you know, people went up to you, you're like, oh, God, it took you a lifetime.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, a lot of players don't know that, you know, until you really start putting all your effort into one category, it's very tough to make it. I mean, unless you're one of those top guys, which it is what it is at that point. But kind of, you know, take us on your path to becoming a specialized doubles player.
Yeah. Well, I always loved to play doubles. I always, you know, played in the juniors, played in college, played quite successfully and all that. But like you said, I was always good enough to get into the slams. I was never good enough to win one, though, unless I put all of my effort into it, you know. And so when it comes to playing 58 before I won them, the first 40 or so of those were just me sort of playing, like you said, challengers and doing well in those and some tour events and, you know, having my ranking be in that 40-50 range where I could find somebody to get into a slam with. And, of course, you're going to do that because – a few extra bucks and a chance to, you know, be a bit longer at a great tournament and all that fun stuff. But I never felt like I was a real threat to win one until I started really working at it, which began in about 2016-17 in that range. And so that's sort of when I feel like, okay, at that point, you know, we can start counting how many tries it really took, because it was really all of my effort was focused on what can I do to win the biggest tournaments in the world in doubles. And you know, it took me until now, or until this Australian Open or whatever. But before that, it was definitely more of a, let's call it a side hustle, as opposed to the main focus, you know.
You obviously had a very good partnership with Raven. Mm-hmm. And then I know you were going to be working with Brian Baker. Mm-hmm. We have talked a couple times with some double specialists about just kind of the seedy underworld of doubles and that partnership. But those are all pretty good, and yourself included, good high character people. How do you make those decisions specifically for you? How have you worked with some of those players to maintain solid friendships despite the fact that maybe the tennis relationship has gone away?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think so much of doubles, at least I've learned this, you know, through the process of playing, is that you have to be sort of, you have to have good chemistry with whoever it is you're playing with. You know, I think the game style stuff is important, but I think it's even more important to have that sort of, you know, yeah, that chemistry on court. So I always say this, the best thing I can do on a doubles court is make my partner play well, because it makes my job a lot easier. So if you have the sort of connection, it helps. And I've just tended to have that with, you know, those two guys you mentioned for sure, Raven and Brian for two. And then now playing with Joe, it's sort of the same kind of thing. And I think, you know, as far as how you to maintain the friendship afterwards, I mean, I've only had one, let's call it, breakup experience, and Raven and I had 2.5 great years, and I just felt like, you know, I'll be honest, I was the one that said, I just felt like, you know, we were sort of at our limit. I felt like we could have done a little bit better with, you know, different types of players, and, you know, said it to him in November of 2017, so gave him enough time to sort out what we were going to do after that. And, you know, we've been real good friends ever since. I mean, I, you know, I think he's a great guy. He's got a great wife and a great family, and we all get along really well. And, you know, it just didn't. And to be honest, I think he's done better since he's gone on. I think he had a couple of great years with Michael Venus as well. And so I think it was a good thing for everybody, you know.
And out of the team of Salisbury and Rahm, you're definitely the experienced one in this relationship.
Yeah, another way to say I'm older. well played.
You've seen a few more tennis courts.
Yeah.
You've seen a few more tennis courts.
I think Joe played his 7th major in Australia before he won, and I was in my 58th, so.
But how do you, you know, for logistically as well as, you know, looking for the, you know, a player, how do you go about, you know, you're definitely the one with more of results than Joe. Like, how do you finding somebody like that? Who do you look for? How do you get connected?
Yeah, I mean, so it's funny. If people think it's super complicated, I always equate it to like junior high dating. It's a bit like, you know, you just like ask somebody if they want to play, and maybe we'll play a couple of weeks, and then we'll see how it goes. And then, you know, I mean, I didn't know anything about Joe before he came and asked me to play. We played a couple times. Yeah, but that was it. Like, I didn't know any. I didn't even know that he went to college. I didn't. You know, he's quite a bit younger, so I literally had never seen the guy before. But he had this knack. I watched him a bit after he asked me to play, and I knew I didn't have a partner for 2019. And, you know, I watched him a bit, and, like, I couldn't really pick out one thing, but the guy just seemed to win all the time.
Yeah.
Like, literally, he just came up – he just seemed to, like, come up with a shot, which you didn't really expect him to make when it counted. I'm like, well, that's a hell of a quality to have to start with in doubles when, you know, we played 2 out of 3 no ad with a 10-point tiebreaker. I mean, half the battle is being clutch. So I'm like, he's got that going for him for sure. And then, you know, then I watched him a bit closer, and it's like, okay, he does do a lot of things awfully well that are sort of, they're not standout-ish, but if you really pay attention, like, he's an incredible athlete, and, like, his ability, and I'm not. I'll be the first one to say that. So that's a nice compliment to start with. You know, he serves pretty well, you know, and he sort of has a similar makeup to me. So I felt like, you know, we could kind of be an imposing team out there. You know, he probably doesn't hit the ball maybe as well as some people, but I feel like that's where I have a bit of a more of a strength than he does. So there's, you know, a couple of things where he doesn't do well that I do well and vice versa. And I thought the compliment was pretty good. And then, you know, in talking to him and chatting with him a few times, seemed like a really nice guy. And, you know, we were able to get along, which I said was probably the most important thing. And I think that's sort of been the key to us being successful, is that, you know, we're pretty open with each other. If we feel like there's something to talk about, we sort of get it out there and are able to, you know, discuss things that way.
And of course, he lost his last collegiate match in Champaign-Urbana at the University of Illinois.
I didn't know that until recently. He had mentioned that, and he kind of slid that in there quietly.
Yeah, I like to bring that up whenever I can with Joe. You know, logistics is something that Noah just mentioned. And listen, we say this all the time, Raj. Since this has all started happening with COVID-19. Obviously, the health impact, the people, the human impact is by far most important. You guys, and the fact that you have a major in your pocket, you're starting to look forward to 2020. This is a massive impact for you in terms of kind of just this opportunity that's in front of you to really make a deep impact into the top of the rankings here in 2020. How has it impacted you personally in that regard, and also the logistics of how you and Joe just maintain the interpersonal relationship when you aren't able to be together?
Yeah, it's good. Two really good questions. He was actually at my house here in California on Sunday, the night that we all heard Indian Wells got canceled. We were supposed to travel to Indian Wells on Monday morning. So, like, he just came over a few days early. We played some golf and hung out here, and then we were going to fly down there. So obviously that was a bit of a shock, and he stayed another few days before figuring out that, you know, it was going to be canceled for a bit longer. So the second part of your question, how do you maintain it? And we chat every, you know, couple times a week. We were working with a guy named Rob Morgan, who's been coaching us just from the beginning of this year. So we just kind of have a phone call similar to this, a FaceTime call, and just sort of just say, hey, how you doing? What are you guys up to? This and that. But yeah, obviously I think it's a bit of good and bad. I mean, as far as how it's impacted us, I mean, I think we're in an incredibly fortunate position that we were able to have a great result already. You know, the year was only 2 months old, and we had a great result, and so many other players that are absolutely as capable as we are just happened to not, you know, and I'm sure they were looking forward to the rest of the season. So, you know, very fortunate to have put that together. But on the flip side, you know, we're at both at career high rankings. We're, you know, the number one team in the world ranking wise for the year to date. And now we got to sit down and not play until who knows when, and who knows what's going to happen with rankings, what they're going to do. But more than rankings, it's just the opportunities of feeling like, geez, we were playing some good tennis and we had some great opportunities ahead of us in New Wells, Miami, obviously the clay and then the grass and, you know, all those events, and feeling like we were one of the top favorites going into them. And no, we're not going to get to play them. And as you said, there are way bigger problems in the world. But from our perspective, as far as tennis players, yeah, it was a bit unfortunate for sure.
You know, I kind of look at this at the mental side of things. I always say that, you know, some of the greatest moments for tennis players is the night of a win when you know you have a day off the next day. You know,
I agree with that.
You feel accomplished. You don't have the pressure of playing the next day. You get to enjoy a practice, eat well, do whatever, and somebody else has to play. You don't have to worry.
Yeah.
So for you, do you get this feeling like, hey, like, I'm pretty accomplished for this year. I get to relax and enjoy this win for like an extra 6 months. Does that even cross your mind a little bit?
That's interesting. It might, now that you put it that way, it might help me think about it a little bit better, but it worked like that. So we decided we were going to play Rotterdam the week. I mean, this just seems so insignificant now, but we were going to play Rotterdam like the week after Australia was over. We had signed up to play that event. And since we did well, we pulled out of that event. And so for that week, I probably felt like exactly like you were saying, all these guys are going to battle it out in some small town in the Netherlands where it's cold and I get to sit home and wait for the next tournament. But after that, I think we were both pretty ready to go just because we felt like we were playing well. And we were, you know, these two tournaments in March are such, you know, such, it's almost like a kickoff for the rest of the year, really, after the Australian opens over and all that. So I think, yeah, maybe in the long run, like I said, I'm in a better position than a lot of people who maybe didn't do as well in Australia, but that feeling was over after that week, I think.
Yeah, I just know if I finish the year in January, I'm really upset, and luckily had some good matches in February, March, where I'm like, okay, I'm not a shitty tennis player, I'm going to remind myself for the next 9 months that I can't hit a tennis ball. So that's like what I was getting at, but yeah.
Raj, you are somebody who, over the years, I've known you to be a relatively quiet, soft-spoken person. You don't get involved in too much social media controversy. You're well regarded. So when you do speak up, it kind of carries a little bit more weight. I know I remember the big one for you was when John McEnroe called Paolo Lorenzi a journeyman, and you started having those kind of discussions. And we're in this weird period now, obviously, where there's kind of this moment where tennis might change, might be forced to change with everything that's happening right now. We have so many different stakeholders in the sport. You are a guy who has been around for a long period of time. Do you think we're at a point where we need a commissioner, we need unification and unionization at the same time? How do you see the sport right now kind of changing with where we're at, impacted by COVID-19?
Well, I think this sort of situation that we're in right now has probably brought out some of the underlying issues that we have in our sport. You know, for example, the French Open just up and moves to September without really telling anybody. And that seems to be okay because it's, you know, an ITF run event and there's a separate organization from the ATP, which is a separate organization from the WTA. And it's like this whole thing, which people don't have a clue how it really works. And to be honest, a lot of us don't really have a clue how it works. I mean, I feel like I got like a tennis 101 lesson when I got elected to the player council in 2016. I had zero idea of how any of this works. So yeah, the short answer to your question is, I think, yeah, it's about time. It probably has been about time for a while, but I think it's, you know, it's definitely now about time that we have some kind of unified representation as far as the players go, as far as the interests of some of the other, you know, parties in the sport, because right now it just feels like we fight ourselves so much of the time, you know, like the players fight tournaments because, you know, we want extra prize money as players. They don't want to give it. You know, there's got to be a better way to do that than to, you know, hire and fire CEOs, you know, as quickly as we seem to, you know. there's got to be a better thing for, you know, how the men's and women's, so granted, I think we as a sport do a great job of making it as equal as possible. But, you know, there are still situations where it would be nice either to be totally separate organizations, ATP and WTA, or maybe together, something to where we have a bit more clarification on that, because I feel like sometimes everybody gets thrown in the mix where we're supposed to be together sometimes, like at the US Open when we've all played under the ITF, you know, umbrella or any of the slams, and then at Indian Wells when we're playing at the same site but we're playing under our own organizations, like how does that really work, you know? So I think there's so, and I'm not saying it's, you know, I don't know how it would change, I don't have the answers to that, but I think unification will help the sport go forward a bit easier than being so dependent on, I feel like one of the biggest problems we have is we're so dependent on our stars, you know. I mean, if Roger and Rafa don't show up to a tournament on the men's side, all of a sudden it's not looking so good, or Novak or Andy or whoever, you know, there's a list of a handful of people, but all of a sudden it's not looking so good anymore, whereas I think it should be a bit more about the whole than just the cream, you know.
Yeah, I think, you know, you know, that always goes to what we talk about. And, you know, Mike and I in the next podcast, we have to talk about the new league I'm creating. Yeah, with my financial backing that I have in my bank account right now. but yeah, we always talk about how the system itself is not conducive to creating something that has enough excitement, has, you know, is promotable enough, is fan friendly enough. We're in the system where, you know, it does go to the stars because that's who they want to see. But mm-hmm. I don't think it's exciting enough as a whole right now to get the new generation involved and excited. And that's a lot of the issues we see. And, you know, through my talks that I've had recently, it seems like unionization is going to be very, very difficult, almost nearly impossible, with too many hoops to jump through. That's where, honestly, the new league talk, it's kind of bullshit. But in the end, it's like this might be one of our only options.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I also think from the other side of it is I feel like we really do a poor job as tennis people in general to think about our sport from the fans' perspective.
Right.
You know, like we always think about what can we get as players, what can tournaments get as tournaments, but we never think about the person who's buying a ticket for, in some cases, a heck of a lot of money to walk through the gates. Like what kind of, you know, experience. What kind of experience they have. You know, it's like I have a quick example. We have a tournament down in Stanford for many years, a women's tournament. My wife went down just to watch, and I had somebody leave her a ticket, not a badge, like literally like a ticket. Okay. And she didn't even pay for it, obviously, because someone left it for her. And she's like, 2 hours into it, she's like, well, this is awful. Like, I can't go inside to get water. I'm just sitting out here. Like, I can't even like leave the court unless it's a changeover. It's like a whole different experience that we have, you know, as people who get credentialed and this and that in these tournaments, as opposed to somebody who just has a ticket. And I just feel like that's never talked about. Like, what is it, you know, what do the, you know, 10,000 people that fill up a stadium, what do they feel like, you know? Whereas you go to a basketball game,
you can get
up and go whenever you want, get your popcorn, get your beer, get your whatever it is, you know. And in tennis, you just can't do that. You know, it's a totally different deal. So.
And yell a bit. I mean, you're allowed to yell at LeBron if you want to.
You know, but you joke around, but that's what we need. We need something to get people involved. And, you know, maybe World Team Tennis is drastic, but we need a college-ish atmosphere. We need to get people to want to be there, to want, you know, to get drunk a little bit and have a DJ in the changeovers and scream at Mike Cation because he's doing an awful job. Like, we want that.
I
feel like that's part of the reason we get to this point where we just have the stars, because people, after all of this, they still want to go see the best players in the world play. But that's it. After you get to the top, out of the top four or five or however many it is, then it's like, well, this experience doesn't really lend itself to me wanting to go see a doubles match out on court 7, you know, or something like that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I had a World Team Tennis match. It was, you know, myself and Evan King playing, and, you know, nothing personal to either of us, but that's not a, you know, a ticket-selling match. But there, we have 2,000 people watching us.
For sure.
It'd be exciting to be out there and just 100% to be during this atmosphere out there enjoying it. And that's something to be said for that. And, you know, to your point, I also don't think we put in consideration media and, you know, all the huge sponsors that we have behind us. I mean, why would Rolex really want to be a part of us besides the top guys? I mean, why do we not talk to these people about what they want to see in the sport when they're putting so much money behind it? You know, I just think this is an overall theme in tennis is clarification, which you said a lot, and lack of communication as well. But we'll see.
So those are my 2 cents on that. I don't have any answers, though, unfortunately.
I'll take a few more dollars if you have any more than 2 cents. Any more than 2 cents.
Rajiv, as we're wrapping up here, because I think, is your driveway right behind you? Is that what's right behind you in the window?
No, it's actually a street that's pretty close, but there's only a couple houses up.
I didn't know.
Is that too bright?
No, I just didn't know if you're that meant your wife. I saw a car just go by. I didn't know if Zainab was.
She's not home right now. She just went out, so I'm home alone. She went for a drive actually, just to get out. Because that's what we do these days.
Yeah, right. I don't know if you knew this, but Zainab, Raj's wife, back in the 2003 era, that we were hitting partners for each other. So, I mean, it's Raj and I are deep, man. I ran his website, for God's sakes. I mean, I have I'm sure down in like my mom's basement, I have a Raj tennis t-shirt.
Maroon one. I remember that.
Exactly. We sold shirts to pay for the website domain. That's how deep it goes. But I will say this, Raj. I've been following, you know, your social media. I never in a million years, going back to say 2002, 2003 when we met, would I have thought that what we'd be seeing in the Raj social media content that we'd be seeing is workout videos. And I am I'm shocked, I'm stunned, and I mean, kudos, my friend. I never thought we'd see that from you.
Longevity, you know, whatever it takes to keep playing tennis, right? I mean, literally whatever it takes, because you know how much I don't enjoy doing that stuff.
Rajiv, thank you. We really do appreciate your time. My best to Zainab as well, your family. I know you guys are out in the San Francisco area, Noah in the New York area. You guys are in two of the areas hit most, you know, hard by COVID-19, and my best to you guys and the health of your families.
Yeah.
We kind of miss you. Just a little.
Yeah.
Just yeah, a little. But stay safe, guys.
All right.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks,
appreciate
Raj.
It.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology with its sleek mid-cut silhouette. It's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
The show might be over, but the conversation isn't. Join us on social media at NoahRubin33, at MikeCTennis, and at Behind the Racket.
Expect new episodes every Monday or Tuesday. And don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. It really helps us expand and reach more listeners as we take you behind the racket.